number 5, Greaves v. Astru, 092216.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Marcy Goldblum on behalf of the plaintiff, Terry Greaves. In this case, the district court abused its discretion in finding the commissioner's position was substantially justified. The district court seems to imply that short of no discussion at all of credibility, an ALJ's legally erroneous credibility assessment will not be the basis of an EJRA award, and that's just not the EJRA standard. In order to be substantially justified, the ALJ's decision must have a reasonable basis in law, a reasonable basis in fact, and a reasonable connection between the facts and the law. Here, looking at the EJRA decision shows that despite pointing out where the ALJ had acted unreasonably and not followed settled precedent, the district court nonetheless found defendant's position substantially justified, and that was an abuse of discretion. Here, both the district court and opposing counsel, they like to paint this remand as being one of just articulation, and defendant will no doubt argue that at the conclusion of its decision in the merits, the district court called this a close case. The magistrate judge can call the case anything he wants. The label isn't what's important. We can agree to call a pig a bird, but it's still not going to fly. Here's the thing. In this case, even if we look at the district court's decision denying the EJRA fee, this wasn't just a case where he looked at the case and said, you know what, there were some problems with the credibility determination, we're going to remand it. He went on beyond that, and this is even from the EJRA denial. The district court says, I also concluded that the ALJ inappropriately discounted the opinion of Ms. Greaves' treating physician because it was not supported by the evidence. In so doing, the ALJ discussed only those positions of the record that bolstered his finding while ignoring those that did not. This was contrary to the requirement that an ALJ must minimally articulate. And the judge goes on and says that in discounting a treating physician's opinion, the ALJ cannot ignore an entire line of evidence contrary to his findings. Now, just looking at that alone, that amount of error on the part of the ALJ, that's the pre-litigation position, that's enough for a finding that the administrative law judge's decision and the pre-litigation position was not substantially justified and that an award of EJRA should have been made. But that wasn't the only error, because prior to that, and actually the first pretty much, I think, 20 pages of the 44-page decision, well, actually past the point where he's discussing the evidence itself, the bulk of the magistrate judge's decision is spent discussing the credibility. And in discussing the credibility, the district court finds that it was not reasonable and not supported. Now, again, let's go back to the definition of what you have to be to find substantial justification. To be substantially justified, there has to be a reasonable basis in fact, a reasonable basis in law, and a reasonable connection between the facts and the law. So just looking at the credibility finding for a moment, the district court found that the ALJ's reasons for discounting credibility were unreasonable and unsupported. Now, when I look at that in terms of a reasonable basis in fact and a reasonable basis in law, it doesn't fit to find that there's substantial justification. Then when you go on to the part where the administrative law judge also ignored a line of evidence, and again, in terms of ignoring a line of evidence, there's multiple instances of that. The ALJ ignored evidence when he was deciding what weight to give the treating physician. In the merits decision, the district court points out that in dismissing or deciding not to credit the treating physician's report, the administrative law judge cites only that part of the record that supported his own opinion and not the medical evidence that supported the treating physician's report. That's legal error. That's well-established precedent. The ALJ can't have had a position that was reasonable in law when he fails to follow so much well-reasoned and long-standing case law. And going to, again, the defendant's argument, in the beginning part of the defendant's argument, they cite to Hallmark and to Coleman. And I bring this up because when I was reviewing and preparing for this argument, I noted that they cited to Hallmark saying that in Hallmark it stood for the fact that an arbitrary and capricious finding doesn't mandate an award of fees. Well, that's not exactly what the Hallmark court said. And what it struck me that if the defendant wasn't clear on what Hallmark said, perhaps the district court wasn't either. When I look at Hallmark, the Seventh Circuit remanded for the district court to reassess the issue of the attorney fees because the court found that the district court's reasoning was troubling because their ultimate finding was at odds with a finding of substantial justification. And again, in Coleman, the court ultimately found that there was a reasonable basis for the court's decision. Now, one of the cases that the district court and the government cites to in support of its position, well, two cases. They cite to Cunningham and they cite to Stein. The Stein case was issued in, I believe, early 1990s, but it was issued before Social Security ruling 96-7P set forth exactly what the ALJ must set forth explicitly. And the ALJ here failed to do that. It's also of note that in the Stein case, the court actually did award some EJ attorney fees. And then the second case, a case that seems to pervade the case we're at today, is Cunningham. And there seems to be this idea of, is it a Cunningham case or is it a Golombewski case? I submit that this is more of a Golombewski case in the sense that, as I pointed out, we're not just talking about a case where the ALJ had a little bit of problems during his credibility analysis. He ignored lines of evidence, and in terms of rejecting the opinion of the treating physician, he ignores that evidence that supports the treating physician's opinion. Again, that in itself is enough legal error, even without the credibility part of it, for a finding that they weren't substantially justified, that they weren't reasonable in fact and law, and that EJIA should be awarded. And then finally, in terms of Cunningham, there seems to be this sense that, well, if we call it failure to articulate, then EJIA fees aren't available. And that's just not the case. What Cunningham says is that there are going to be some cases where the ALJ's failure to articulate doesn't reach the level of a lack of substantial justification, but I submit that this is not one of those cases. If you look at error after error after error that is found by the district court, you cannot have that level of error and still find that the government's position had a reasonable basis in both fact and law.
Did this go back to the same ALJ?
Actually, interestingly, it did not. After the remand, the case went back to the Appeals Council, and the Appeals Council awarded a fully favorable decision. Ms. Greaves had filed a second application where she'd been found disabled, and when the Appeals Council looked at the whole chronology, they found that she was disabled back to the original date of disability, so it never went back to an administrative law judge.
Thank you, Ms. Goldblum. Ms. Pedersen?
Good Good morning.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Danielle Pedersen, and I'm here this morning on behalf of the Commissioner of Social Security.
And could you begin on the point that counsel left last referred to, which is, you know, if there were legitimate credibility concerns, why did the commissioner grant Greaves benefits on remand without undertaking a more thorough credibility analysis or sending it back to the ALJ?
Well, to be honest with you, Judge, our office is never privy to what happens if a case goes back on remand and is handled at the Appeals Council. We do not receive a copy of that decision, and therefore that is not something I have viewed. I would have to speculate in order to answer your question. However, Ms. Goldblum did mention that there was a subsequent application for benefits. There was an issue here where we had a very young individual. Ms. Greaves was 39 at the time of the ALJ's decision. She had a condition that her physicians had said is one that can worsen over time, and it's possible there was a suggestion or evidence in the record that a worsening in the condition took place. But again, without having seen the Appeals Council's decision, I honestly couldn't answer.
Well, then let me put the question this way. Given the way that it was handled, even though you don't know the reasons, I mean, doesn't that have some impact on whether they're entitled to fees, given, as counsel argued, the so many errors that the ALJ made?
I think that this court has never stated that it will engage in a number of errors counting analysis any more than it will engage in a number of issues on which the commissioner prevailed sort of analysis. I mean, the court talked about that a little bit in Stewart. I think that the key here, and I don't think the commissioner is arguing that this case is identical to Cunningham any more than I think that Ms. Greaves and counsel are arguing that this case is identical to Golombewski. This court knows that it will look at each of these cases individually and make a determination. Most importantly, and I want to stress this because it didn't come up during Ms. Greaves' portion of the oral argument, this court will review this decision for an abuse of discretion. And I think if we start with the district court's decision in this case, which is where we should start because of that very deferential standard of review, you will see that the district court in this case made a very, very thorough and well-reasoned determination that EJF fees should not be awarded in this case. Now, the court did liken this case to the Cunningham case, and I think there's some very important reasons why that is. The errors that took place in Cunningham are virtually identical to the errors that the ALJ is accused of in this case. In both Cunningham and this case, the ALJ failed to follow not only the regulations, which, by the way, were in place at the time this court decided Cunningham, but also case law of this circuit determining what factors an ALJ must look at in assessing credibility and the weight to be given to a treating physician's opinion. Obviously, the district court found that the commissioner ran afoul of both the case law and the regulations, which is why we have a remand in this case. However, we have to look at whether or not the commissioner's position was substantially justified from an entirely different perspective. As Coleman stated, this court, when it issued Coleman, the question is whether the agency had a rational ground for thinking it had a rational ground for its actions. I think that the distinction between the Cunningham case and Conrad, another important case where this court upheld the denial of EJF fees, is that in those cases the concern was the failure to adequately build this logical bridge. And that is a longstanding theme of this court and the result of many remands from this court against the agency where that logical bridge has not been built. And it's clear that where that bridge has not been adequately built, there will be a remand. The absence of that bridge, however, has been repeatedly held by this court not to be an automatic reason to grant EJF fees. And that is never more clear than in the Cunningham decision, the Conrad decision, and in Stein, which has already been cited to. Let's contrast that with Golombewski. And Judge Bauer, when writing the per curiam decision in Golombewski, had a very different problem. The court in that case, if you look at the decision, was not necessarily concerned with the absence of an adequate bridge. We were missing the footings of that bridge in the Golombewski case. The Golombewski ALJ did not even make a credibility finding. It wasn't a problem of not sufficiently explaining how that credibility finding was reached. There was no credibility finding whatsoever. That is the primary thing that the court hinged that decision on to reverse and award EJF fees. The other end of the bridge was similarly lacking in Golombiewski. The court found there was no evidentiary foundation for the conclusions reached by the ALJ. That is not the case we have here. As the district court stated in its decision on EJA, the decision here, unlike Golombiewski, is not based on speculation. The district court pointed to numerous pieces of evidence in the record that it said, had the ALJ discussed them more clearly, might have resulted in a affirmance in this case, particularly significant evidence that Ms. Greaves was not being honest with her physicians about her drinking, about what other doctors had said about what treatment would be appropriate, and there were several different inconsistencies that were identified. Now, the ALJ did note these inconsistencies and did discuss this evidence in his decision, and he also made a clear finding that she was not credible and gave some reasoning about why he found that. The skeletal bridge was there. The problem was the failure to connect the dots. And again, in Cunningham, in Conrad, in Stein, in Coleman, this court has held that the failure to connect the dots is not by itself an automatic finding that there should not be fees awarded. The Hallmark case that came up, I want to address that very briefly. I think the key to Hallmark is that this court said that the language used by the district court in their remand order is one factor. It's not the only factor. The judge here did say this was a close case. I think he was speaking mostly to the evidence in this case. He specifically said, had the ALJ mentioned a little bit more of this evidence and had fleshed out that bridge just a little more, he admitted this may have come out differently. He said this was very close to not being a remand. And we talk about a basis in the law for my office's position in arguing this case, and for the ALJ. Let's look back at several cases that were not EJA cases where this court affirmed on the merits despite the fact that an ALJ misstated the facts. That's from Jens. Despite the fact that the ALJ ignored an entire line of evidence. That's Johansson. And despite the fact that the ALJ failed to follow the regulations in citing every single credibility factor and going through that in more detail. In fact, when this court issued its decision in Jens, it specifically said that although there are omissions in the ALJ's credibility finding, that by itself is not enough to find there is not substantial evidence in the record to support the commissioner's decision. So there we have cases where the same errors were made, similar errors as the ALJ in this case, but we nonetheless have an affirmance on the merits. That, I think, does bolster the district court's finding that this is a close case. And that strong language was something that the district court did mention. It's not the only factor. It was certainly one such factor that he properly considered. The district court considered all of the case law cited by Ms. Greaves in her argument and also cited several other cases coming down as precedential from this court. He does a very nice job of analyzing that law and of explaining in great detail why he came to the conclusion that the government's position was substantially justified. He considered the overall closeness of the case. He considered the fact that there was a significant amount of evidence in the record to support the ALJ's ultimate conclusions, even if the ALJ did not provide enough analysis of why those reasons connected to his ultimate findings. And again, he did not issue count in this case. I think the very brief mention by the district court that we prevailed on one issue, which was the issue as to the reasonableness of the hypothetical question, the court did not engage in issue counting, and the argument that Ms. Greaves raises on that has already been squarely dealt with in Stewart, and I know the court knows that. So Ms. Greaves has simply failed to show this court that the record in this case commands a conclusion that the district court was wrong. And that is the standard this court has set forth for an abuse of discretion. The commissioner therefore respectfully requests that the court find the district court did not abuse its discretion in finding that the commissioner's position was substantially justified and therefore uphold the denial of EJA fees in this case.
Thank you, Ms. Pedersen.
Thank you.
Ms. Goldblum, how much time? 1 minute.
To begin with, at the very beginning of my presentation here, I stated that we were here because the district court had abused its discretion. And this is not just a credibility case, and it's not just a failure to connect the dots. If we look at page 41 of the merits decision, The district court says, second, the ALJ discounted Dr. Jones's opinion because, in his view, Ms. Greaves' daily activities were not consistent with it. He based his conclusion on Ms. Greaves' statements to Dr. Franklin that she hurt herself while doing laundry, which the ALJ concluded conflicted with her testimony that she did not do laundry anymore. This conclusion is not supportable. It was precisely because she had hurt herself doing laundry in November 2006 that she would say at the hearing in early 2007 that she could no longer do laundry. More importantly, the ALJ ignored the myriad limitations on Ms. Greaves' daily activities that were completely consistent with Dr. Jones's opinion. While it is not the court's role to reweigh the evidence, the ALJ must at least minimally address some of the factors that are contrary to his conclusion in order to make an informed review of the decision. The ALJ, in this case, simply discounted Dr. Jones's opinion without addressing any of the evidence that supported it. That, right there, is harmful legal error that cannot be the basis of a finding of a reasonable basis in law. We do believe that there has been a mandate showing an abuse of discretion on the part of the district court. We ask that you remand for a calculation and award of benefits.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Counsel, thank you for the fine arguments and briefs. We'll take the case under advisement.